You are listening to The Real Shia Beliefs, a collaboration between Thacker Lane and Al Hujah Islamic Seminary. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider becoming our patron by donating at thackerlane.org/support.
We continue our discussion on taqleed. Previously, we examined the rational basis for taqleed. And in Arabic, briefly, scholars have coined this term to summarize the entire discussion. Wujub, rujoo' al-jahil ila al-alim. It's a rational law that if you are not an expert in a field, you refer to an expert. Very simple. So we examined the rational basis for it. One other indication that this is rational is that you find rational people historically referring to scholars, even though they may not have called it taqlid, but in reality, since the days of the imams, people would do taqlid. Do we have a historical reference from the early scholars that verifies this? Yes. We have, for instance, a Shaykh At-Tusi. He says, وَالَّذِي نَذْهَبُ إِلَيْهِ Our opinion, our view is that أَنَّهُ يَجُوزُ لِلْعَامِ A layman can do the following. Who's the layman? الَّذِي لَا يَقْدِرُ عَلَى الْبَحْثِ وَالتَّفْتِيشِ The one who's not able to go and search for the proper hadiths to derive rulings. One who's not a scholar. What is he allowed to do? تَقْلِيدُ الْعَالِمِ He can refer to a scholar. He even uses the word taqlid. Remember, Shaykh At-Tusi is 1,000 years ago. So taqlid is not this new phenomenon in this age as some are suggesting. Shaykh At-Tusi recognized this 1,000 years ago. What's your proof? Shaykh At-Tusi, what's your proof that we can do taqlid? He cites what is called rational practice, Sirat al-Uqala. He says, يَدُلُّ عَلَى ذَلِكَ أَنِّي وَجَدْتُ عَامَّةَ الطَّائِفَةِ I saw the entire Shia school of thought. Without an exception. مِنْ عَهْدِ أَمِيرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ عَلَيْهِ السَّلَامِ Since the era of Imam Ali, إِلَى زَمَانِنَا هَذَا Until this era, after the ghaibah. يَرْجَعُونَ إِلَى عُلَمَائِنَا إِلَى عُلَمَائِهَا We see that the Shia, they refer to their scholars. وَيَسْتَفْتُونَهُمْ فِي الْأَحْكَامِ وَالْعِبَادَاتِ They take the fatwa of scholars in rulings and in acts of worship. وَيُفْتُونَهُمُ الْعُلَمَاءُ فِيهَا And the scholars, they issue their fatwa in that field. So, a Shaykh At-Tusi is citing rational practice. I see the tradition historically is for the layman to refer to the scholars. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. So this is not a new phenomenon. Notice that Shaykh At-Tusi says not since the ghaibah. Since which era? Which imam? Imam Ali alayhi salam. That means Shaykh At-Tusi here is certifying. He is attesting that even in the presence of imams, people would still do taqlid of scholars. For those who obviously did not have direct access to the imams, they were either in other cities or villages, or they didn't always have the pleasure of meeting the imam alayhi salam. So is taqlid a new phenomenon, or is this something since the days of Imam Ali, by the words of a Shaykh At-Tusi? Because one big challenge that we have today, there are some who are claiming that back then there was no taqlid. This is something that's recent, maybe 200 years old. And then later on, we'll examine the Akhbari, Usuli, you know, dispute. And a lot of people claim that Akhbaris don't believe in taqlid, whereas the Usulis invented this taqlid system. We'll examine that later. But this is evidence now that taqlid was there since the day of Imam Ali alayhi salam, where the one who's not an expert refers to the expert and takes fatwas from them. He uses the word taqlid and fatwa. Keep that in mind. So previously, we examined rational practice, rational laws that support taqlid, and now we have rational practice. And by the way, because the concept of taqlid is so rational, It's not limited to the Shia school of thought. Sunnis also have taqleed. Yes, their criteria for whom they do taqleed of differs than us. But the idea of taqleed is something all Sunni schools of thought believe in. I'll give you an example, two examples, in fact. Today, when you are classifying the Sunni schools of thought, what are the four main ones? Well, Wahhabi is more recent. Hanbali, Hanafi, Shafi'i, Maliki. What are these names? The leaders of these schools of thought. Abu Hanifa is the leader of the Hanafi school of thought. Shafi'i, Malik ibn Anas, and Ahmad ibn Hanbal. Every Sunni today who subscribes to this school of thought, to his madhab, is following, doing taqlid of one of these four. That's the essence of taqlid. Because in reality, where is the Sunni getting his fiqh laws from? Not from the Prophet directly, no. From Abu Hanifa's opinions and fatwas, Shafi'i's opinions and fatwas, Ahmad ibn Hanbal's opinions and fatwas, they're doing taqlid. The only difference between us and them is that they've limited taqlid to four individuals and they pretty much closed the door of ijtihad. Whereas we, the Shia, we say no. Religion needs scholars in every era in order to give us their scholarly jurisprudence. Really, that's the difference. Otherwise, they also do taqlid. They've limited it to four individuals. What? And our question to them, why does Abu Hanifa have the privilege to make his own fiqh school of thought? Why? Did God say that in the Quran? Did the Prophet say that? Only these four have the right to use their ijtihad in these issues? That's our challenge to them. That's our question to them. Yes, brother.
When those four individuals pass away, are they gonna come out with new ones? Or
well, historically, they tried to stick to the opinions of these four individuals.
Okay.
Yes, recently we see progress in the Sunni world. And today you have muftis. Have you heard of muftis? Like each kingdom or Arabian country or Islamic country assigns a mufti. Well, what does a mufti do? A mufti does operate within some, within the framework of their school of thought. So they're experts on Abu Hanifa, let's say, if he's a Hanafi mufti. But he does give you his own fatwas. They look at new cases, they look at the texts, they issue fatwas. Just like a marja issues a fatwa, these muftis today, they are issuing fatwas. That's taqlid. That's a type of taqlid. In fact, I would like to share with you the exact quote of Ibn Uthaymeen. Ibn Uthaymeen is a very well-known Sunni scholar. Yes, we consider him to be influenced by Wahhabism and to be an extremist, but he is a Sunni scholar. Listen to his words. And in the book, Liqa'at al-Bab al-Maftuh, Ibn Uthaymeen says the layman must do taqlid. He even uses the word taqlid. Yes, he puts a restriction. The restriction that he puts is that the scholar that you're following must be in your city. You cannot follow someone who lives in a different place. Why? What's his philosophy? He says, because if you can choose the fatwa of any scholar, then you will start picking and choosing. Oh, there's this mufti in Tunis. His fatwas are really flexible in this area. Let me follow him. And then there is this mufti in Syria. He's also very flexible. And then you start picking and choosing. Ibn Uthaymeen says, that's not right. This is not the proper way of doing taqlid. Stick to a scholar who's in your area and just do taqlid of them. But he uses the word taqlid in this book. That means Sunnis also believe in taqlid. The only difference is the criteria, who's qualified. We say someone must be educated in the school of Ahlul Bayt. You do taqlid of them. They say no. We have other schools of thought. Really, that's the core difference. But the concept of taqlid is so rational, it's so necessary, there is no other alternative that even Sunnis have taqlid. So the one who says that taqlid is a Shia innovation, no, Sunnis have been doing taqlid since the days of Abu Hanifa. And in fact, their taqlid is less flexible than our taqlid. Our taqlid is more progressive, it's more realistic, it addresses our challenges better. So there you go. You have evidence that people who want to practice religion, they have to refer to scholars. And that's really the basic idea with taqlid. Yes, brother.
So generally speaking, Sayyidina, do Sunnis really have a big issue with taqlid, or is it just a new phenomenon now in this day and age where people generally are just questioning taqlid?
It's a modern phenomenon. Historically, Sunnis did not have a problem with taqlid. It's a more of a modern phenomenon where you see media being used to slander the Shia, to disqualify the Marja'iyya system, the Hawza institutions. So they're accusing the Shia of, you have this innovation where you blindly follow your scholars. Well, you Sunnis have been doing that for over 1,000 years now. What's the difference? Really, what's the difference? Just like you blindly follow Abu Hanifa without really challenging him as a layman, I follow someone in my era who's an expert. What's the difference? Yes, Abu Hanifa is closer historically to the era of the Prophet ﷺ, but he uses his opinion. That's the core idea here. So, historically it was not really an issue. It's more of a modern phenomenon to disqualify the Marja'iyya system.
So, I mean, along those lines in today's world, so maybe 100 years ago, information was not readily available to justify taqlid. But today, there is so much information to back that thought process. How is it that it's becoming more of an issue today, whereas information is readily available to justify taqlid, yet many are questioning it?
I think there are some natural factors. One of them is the failure of a lot of Sunni institutions when it comes to religious authority. They don't have central authority, organized system. That's why you have groups like Daesh and ISIS, and they claim legitimacy, right? Whereas when they see the Shia system and how the Shias are committed to their Marja'iyya system and scholars, and how that's a source of strength, even in times of chaos and turmoil like Iraq, the Marja'iyya was a source of strength and unification for the Shia. They despise that. So how do they weaken the Shia? Let's start a media campaign against their Marja'iyya system. If you weaken the belief of the Shia and their scholars, they as a community become weaker. That's one natural factor that's causing them to question this and to highlight it in the media.
I mean, the way you just mentioned it just sounds out of mere jealousy, perhaps, that they envy.
Part of it is envy and jealousy, but part of it is they realize this is a source of strength for us. It's an area of strength. And because they consider us their enemies or heretics, if they see us having an area of strength, obviously they would like to weaken us. So even if there is no jealousy involved, the fact that they see us as heretics, they see the Marja'iyya as a very strong point that we have in our school of thought. So they would like to weaken that because they know that that will weaken the Shia altogether. So that's natural. It's expected for them to do that in this time and era.
Well, how about some modern day speakers within the Shia school of thought that could be essentially muddying the waters with that thought process? How would you explain their thought?
There are some speakers who highlight these controversies, obviously, and they might push for some agenda against the whole system of taqlid. Without passing a judgment on them, some of them do so for personal interests because they might not have received the spotlight from the seminaries, so they're finding an alternative way. That happens with a number of them. You know, some people want recognition. So if the marja or the Hawza institution does not give them that recognition that they're craving for, they will take an alternative route to get attention. A lot of times it really boils down to that. It's sad, but it does boil down to that. So this is a challenge. This is a challenge that we do have. Some of them, if we want to give them the benefit of the doubt, they might not be aware of how the Marja'iyya is a source of strength. They don't have much experience in reading Shia history, in the role of Shia scholars in really saving the Shia community. Some of them are not aware of that. When you talk to them, you know, they're shocked. Have you read the history of Shia scholars? The Marjas, the tobacco revolution, the 1920 Iraqi revolution, that revolution, the Mashruta, this. Are you aware of that? They're not aware of that. They heard one or two stories of someone connected to the marja who misused khums, and that's it. They want to disqualify the whole system. They take a small little incident, they make big generalizations out of ignorance. If I want to give them the benefit of the doubt, it's out of ignorance.
Is it just ignorance, or would you say arrogance and just crazy?
Well, arrogance goes back to the first point that I mentioned. Some of them, it's out of arrogance and wanting attention. So that's how they disqualify the system, to get attention. Then there's a second category. It may be arrogance, yes. If I want to give them the benefit of the doubt, it's ignorance. So it's either arrogance or ignorance. Yes.
Okay, so we follow our scholars with their knowledge and information from Ahlul Bayt, but where do they claim they get their information? Their scholars get their information from?
Well, they get it from their own system of hadith, from Bukhari, from the canonical texts, from their own jurisprudence. Each Sunni school of thought has its particular system. So they see companions, for instance, as having the authority after the Prophet. So if there's a hadith from a companion on a religious matter, they accept it. They accept whatever Bukhari chose as a hadith, a lot of them will accept it. Just because it's in Bukhari, let's consider it sahih. Or they just accept what Abu Hanifa said, what Shafi'i said in a legal matter. They see them as the sources of authority, not the Ahlul Bayt. That's why Bukhari, who was a contemporary of Imam al-Jawad, for instance, he doesn't narrate a single hadith from Imam al-Jawad. And that's why you see Sunnis historically have not recognized the religious authority of these later Imams.
But what he said, what if those four die? What happens?
They continue their path. They just continue. They try to figure out what was Abu Hanifa's system to apply it to modern cases. So they're still following him. Like his book of rulings, they still follow it.
We do that to a certain extent too, because it's not mandatory for somebody where they're doing a taqlid of a scholar, modern day scholar who passes away, they're not obligated to switch.
Well, most Shia ulama, they say if you followed someone in your lifetime, you can stay following them, but not to start following someone who passed away, right? So it's quite different. In the end, we do have that condition that you must follow a living scholar to begin with. You can stay on that scholar, sure, but you must have followed him in your lifetime. Whereas they say, no, you know, we could follow someone who lived 1,000 years ago.
Not to be the dead horse, but there are the two famous books where these types of debates have taken place, such as Peshawar Nights and Mulajat. And in these books, there are very specific references to the books of the Sunni schools of thought, such as Bukhari and whatnot. There are some out there who are now have started this wave that, you know, these two books are pretty much made up. Somebody just decided to write them up. These events did not occur. But how can they deny the evidence that's provided in these books in terms of the various matters or concerns?
The fabrications that have been made?
Right.
Well, in reality, if you disqualify these books, there is no foundation for those schools of thought. And when you're put in that spot, there's historical pressure on you. There's global pressure on you. What alternative do they have? If I come out and admit, like some scholars are, by the way, especially in Egypt, a number of Egyptian professors and doctors and experts in Islamic law from Al-Azhar are coming and doubting Bukhari. They're taking a lot of heat for it, but they have the courage to do so. If I disqualify the system, what other alternative do I have? Nothing. So they're stuck in this situation. Because they're not going to admit that the Ahlul Bayt and that whole history is the alternative, obviously, for political reasons and historical reasons. So even though some of them know, I've heard some of them privately telling some of their friends, we don't have an alternative. What do I do? What's my alternative?
Can they consider that a sense of awakening where they can see it now? Because there is no alternative. I mean, there has to be an answer to everything. The fact that there is not an alternative, is it easier to just stick to the path of wrong?
It's convenient.
It's convenient.
Yes, it's convenient. Because if you want to go against the system, you lose credibility, you lose your status, you lose your followers, you lose your paycheck. Some of them clearly had stated to a Shia scholar whom he befriended, he told him, I know everything you have is the haqq, but I am here, a local imam of a mosque in one of the Middle Eastern countries. I have a community that respects me. I have a paycheck. I have a family to support. If I come and admit, what's my alternative? Go and become a janitor? Who's gonna take care of me anymore? So I'm not willing to have that severe change in my lifestyle. So it's not easy. It requires a huge sacrifice. Not everyone's willing to make that sacrifice. Boils down to that.